Good morning to all. I call to order the Audit Compliance and Title IX Committee hearing beginning at 8 o'clock on Wednesday morning. May I take roll call, please?
Chair Arriscotta.
Here.
Regent Boylan. Regent Brager. Regent Del Carlo.
I'm here.
We do not have a quorum.
I'm here. This is Snoop. I'm sorry.
There we go. We do have a quorum.
Wonderful. Thank you all. Thank you very much, Ms. Palmer. If Regent Del Carlo will lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance, I'd appreciate it. Wonderful. Before beginning, we take a moment to recognize that here in Nevada, we stand on the land of the Washoe, Numu, Northern Paiute, the Nuwi, the Western Shoshone, and the Nuwu, Southern Paiute. We take a moment to recognize and honor their stewardship that continues into today. With this recognition, we state an intention to rightfully include their voice and respect them as the 27 sovereign tribal nations. Prior to going into in-person public comment, I'd like to make a quick comment also in regards to the options to call in for public comment. For those who would like to call in and offer public comment, please dial 669-444-9171 and enter meeting ID 928-4944-5069 and passcode 555-555. So I'll ask for public comment from the meeting sites first. First, we're going to go to Great Basin College. Is there any public comment up in Elko?
No, none here.
Wonderful. I'm going to start in Reno and then we'll transition down to Las Vegas. Is there public comment in Reno?
Good morning, Chair Arriscotta and members. The auditor for the single audit report and financial statements in Agenda Item 7 found a number of compliance issues. That is not totally unexpected for a new auditor and a large and complex enterprise like ENSHI. But the large number of findings does raise concerns. ENSHI's task is to set up the appropriate controls and systematic corrections, hopefully with reasonable efficiency and cost. The ghost student fraud at CSN stands out for the sheer magnitude of losses. We hear anecdotal reports of ghost students elsewhere, so this is likely a problem at other institutions. We obviously need controls that prevent the fraud. However, course instructors should not be held responsible or tasked with procedures that are unworkable for them and for legitimate students, such as requiring in-person activities for completely online courses that may have out-of-state and out-of-country students. If remote proctoring is required, mechanisms should be established and funded for that purpose. Possibly restrictions on how financial aid is paid out may be needed, but that could also hurt legitimate students, so we need to be careful. Perhaps it is necessary to set up some kind of direct payments or voucher systems for registration fees, residence halls, and other fees, or secure custodial accounts to receive the funds. Regarding the changes to the Title IX regulations, our national affiliate, the American Association of University Professors, has opposed the expansion of mandatory reporting to include all faculty. That interferes with the trust relationship between the instructor and student. Since it is in the new federal regulations, however, we must comply. There needs to be robust education for both faculty and students about how students can seek confidential counseling and assistance. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there additional public comment from Reno? None seen. Is there a public comment from the Las Vegas site?
There is none.
Thank you, Ms. Palmer. We're going to move over to consent items number, or agenda item number two, consent items. And we're going to just go ahead and take the consent items in one big swoop. Is there a motion on the table for an approval of consent items?
Chair
Erskine, make a motion.
Make the motion. Or I'll second the motion to Susan Brager, please.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Regent Del Carlo and Regent Brager. Regent Brager with the first motion, Carol, Regent Del Carlo with the second. Are there any in opposition? All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed? Wonderful. Motion carries. One of the items that I do have to mention is on consent item 2B, as in Bravo. The duration between the two audits was 11 years. After reviewing past committee meetings and archive notes, this duration between the audits appears incongruent with past cycles and something that we will definitely address in the future. All right, let's move on to agenda item number three, which is the chair's report. My chair's report is going to be a little bit unique today, as I was going to identify and focus on some of the filling of positions with the Systems Administration Office, mostly with the audit. And I want to commend our Chief Internal Auditor, Lauren Tripp, for providing copious amounts of information. Great job done. But however, because this is a fairly condensed meeting with a lot of information, I'm going to defer my time over to the future agenda items, and we'll definitely go over future staffing either for a special meeting and or during our upcoming quarterly meeting. So let's move over to agenda item number four. And this is the communications with those charged with governance and uniform guide audit report and financial statements for INSHE. And this is for possible action. And I am going to let Mr. Schlicker, partner of Ide Bailey, introduce himself and his team and send it on down to Las Vegas with Mr. Schlicker. Please, sir, go right ahead.
Perfect. Thank you, Kurt Schlicker with Ide Bailey, for the record. Regent Erskine, or Chair Erskine and Regents, thank you for having us here today. As you know, we were selected as the systems auditors for fiscal year 2024 to perform the single audit, and we're happy to say that we completed the work, we completed it on time, and we're here presenting to you today in December. We're going to go over the results of the audit. Happy to answer any questions that you all have throughout the audit. We understand that there are a number of findings that may or may not have additional questions, but again, happy to go over any details and any questions that you have. Now, if I can figure out how to advance the slides. Perfect. Thank you. Okay. So to kind of explain the single audit process to everyone, there's two components to the audit, really. There's the financial statements, and these are the balances that are presented within the financial statements. So cash, liabilities, revenue, expenses, those type of items. We focus on those items, the amounts in the notes to the financial statements, and some other supplementary information. Our job and our charge is to provide reasonable assurance, or hopefully reasonable assurance, that those numbers presented in the financial statements are fairly stated. It's not absolute assurance because we don't audit every single transaction that the system has. We use sampling techniques and other auditor techniques to get a reasonable assurance that they're fairly stated. Our conclusions on that are presented in the independent auditor's report, which again we'll go over in a minute. And then internal control related matters with respect to the financial statements are presented in the independent auditor's report on internal control over financial reporting. And that report, again, is focused on internal controls with respect to the balances presented in the financial statements. So cash, investments, revenue, expenses, etc. The other component of the audit is federal compliance or uniform guidance. This is a focus on direct and material compliance requirements for the major programs selected for audit. And I know I kind of said maybe some confusing words there, but when we look at programs like research and development, student financial aid, the ARPA monies, those type of programs, we evaluate them for compliance requirements that are significant. And then we audit compliance with those significant compliance requirements. Our results of that are presented in the independent auditor's report on compliance for each major federal program, and then report on internal control over compliance. Okay, so two components, one on balances, one on federal programs. With the financial statement audit, we focus on balances that could be material to the user. So we're not, you know, if you look at the system's financial statements, we're not worried about $100 errors. We're worried about big errors, millions of dollars of errors. We do evaluate significant risks, whether due to fraud or error. Our significant risks that we identified during the audit is management override of internal controls. This is a presumptive risk. It's not unusual, so don't panic that we think there's management override going on. This is a presumptive risk in the audit world that we have to assume that management may override internal controls. Improper revenue recognition, again, is a presumptive risk that maybe revenue is not being recognized appropriately. The system has a lot of alternative investments, so it's a large balance. They're difficult to value. We look at that as a significant risk as well to make sure that the system is valuing alternative investments appropriately. And then we have other significant estimates such as the pension liability, the other post-employment benefits liability, and then, of course, allowance for doubtful accounts, specifically with tuition, that are significant estimates as well. We design our audit procedures to address these risks. We come up with specific procedures. We focus on them to hopefully ensure that ultimately everything's recorded appropriately. We do a mix of analytics, sampling, vouching. We pull large sample sizes. We look at a lot of documents, but again, for reasonable assurance, not absolute assurance. To kind of put in perspective of what we look at and what we don't, the system has system-related organizations or discretely presented component units. And we have a list up there shown on the screen of all the related entities to the system that are included within that system-related organization. So it's mostly the foundations and a couple of other entities. We as Ide Bailey do audit several of the component units, UNR Foundation, Wolfpath Athletic, and UNLV Medicine. And then you can see the other component units down there that make up the majority. Those were audited by other auditors. And so if you do read our opinion, we kind of say these entities were audited by others, so our report does not cover those audits performed by other audit firms. They take responsibility for their own audits. The uniform guidance audit, again, is the federal compliance side. There's a prescriptive formula in federal regulation for how to select major programs, and then there's a little bit of risk assessment and judgment made by the auditor. But we go through a major program selection process early on when we receive the draft schedule of expenditures of federal awards during the summer, and this year we picked 10 major programs as a result of that. Smaller programs will be rotated in over time. They don't happen every year. You know, every 5, 6, 7, 10 years, something like that, depending on how large the program is. Again, we identify significant risks for this component of the audit as well. Similarly, we have to presume there's a potential for management override of internal controls. Some of the programs are particularly complex. Some of the requirements may be complex, and so we look at those specifically. The research and development cluster is very large, very decentralized, spread out over a lot of different grants. That's particularly risky just because of the nature of the program. Student financial aid is particularly risky just because of how complex the program is. It's not an easy program. The ARPA monies under the fiscal recovery funds, those were identified as high risk by the Office of Management and Budget. So we follow along with that and look at that as well. And then indirect costs can be particularly risky just due to the nature of the difficulty of that calculation and how that's applied throughout the audit. Again, similar to the financial audit, We design procedures to address these risks, but we're more focused here on compliance. So not necessarily the dollar amounts, but the compliance piece. Before I use a summary of the major programs that we audited, so research and development, student financial aid, SNAP, fiscal recovery funds, adult ed, et cetera, as you go down, we audited approximately $593 million, which is almost 85% of the total federal expenditures for the year for the system. So we had lots of coverage. A lot of programs were audited. That is a contributing factor to the number of findings. So when you compare year to year, especially the federal compliance, the number of programs that are audited is a contributing factor to the quantity of findings, if that makes sense. To kind of explain findings and what's severe, what's a bad finding, you know, all findings are significant, right? They're all important, but there's different severities to the findings. So I do want to highlight and explain the different severities. Our most severe finding is material noncompliance. Material noncompliance is a qualified opinion. Okay, so I think most of you, when you think about audits, there's, you know, the unqualified opinion or the unmodified opinion. Material noncompliance is a qualified opinion, and it's qualified with respect to that compliance requirement. A material weakness is the middle tier, where that's a deficiency or a combination of deficiencies in internal control, that there's a reasonable possibility that material noncompliance can occur. Okay, and then a significant deficiency, even though it maybe sounds the worst because we say significant, that's actually a less severe finding than a material weakness. It's still important enough to bring to everyone's attention, but it's not as severe as a material weakness because we don't think it quite rises to the level of potentially allowing for a material noncompliance to occur. Okay, important, but not as severe. So before you are the financial statement audit results. And on the left, you can see we have 5 material weaknesses in the financial statements, and then 1 significant deficiency. These material weaknesses relate to balances reported for the system's net position, the preparation of the schedule of expenditures of federal awards, accounting for service concession arrangements, the restatement of those system-related organizations. There was an entity that previously was not included within the system's financial statements that upon further review needed to be, and so that was brought in. And then the student enrollment system at CSN. We're going to cover that one in a little bit more detail in just a minute. Due to the sensitive nature of that, we thought it warrant a little bit more discussion on that. And then again, there's another net position finding as a significant deficiency. For the federal compliance or the uniform guidance audit results, we have 2 material noncompliances. Again, these findings result in a qualified opinion with respect to these compliance requirements. So we do have a qualified opinion for research and development over subrecipient monitoring and a qualified opinion for student financial aid over enrollment reporting. We have a number of material weaknesses, 6 of them, as you can see above, over a bevy of the program, student financial aid, fiscal recovery funds, adult ed, the child care development cluster, and community mental health. And then 10 significant deficiencies over to the right, again, less severe, research and development, student financial aid, fiscal recovery, adult ed, IPE, Head Start, and community mental health. So I did want to take a little bit of time to talk about a few of the findings that we thought may be of most interest to the board. I have a little bit of discussion around them. Of course, we're happy to answer questions on these or any of the other findings. But in particular, finding number 5, which is over the student enrollment at College of Southern Nevada. And we did report that there was a ghost student fraud. And when we evaluated this and management, I do want to say management was fully cooperative. They disclosed it to us. They worked with us the entire time. We discussed it. It wasn't hidden. It wasn't like we stumbled across it and then like, oh, you found it. No, they disclosed it to us, and we worked with them through the process, so they were very cooperative. The estimated impact was roughly a $3.2 million in return of Title IV funds and $4 million in outstanding tuition and fees that needed to be written off, and then some other ancillary costs. And when we evaluated this finding, you know, one of the questions that comes up is, hey, we were a victim of a fraud. Why are we getting a finding? That seems a little unfair. And we understand that perspective, and we get it. But we have to step back as the auditors and say, okay, well, what allowed the fraud to occur? And was there a breakdown in internal controls? Was there something that could have prevented the fraud or detected it timely to mitigate the effects of the fraud? And so when we went through that analysis, we said there was a lack of internal controls or some various circumstances that allowed the fraud to occur and not mitigate the effects as timely as otherwise could be. Fair or not, we evaluated that and said, there's an internal control issue here that needs to be addressed and corrected. You know, there's a $7+ million impact to the school. If you look at the nature of the finding, it's roughly 10% of enrollment were ghost students. And when we looked at 10% of enrollment as being ghost students, we said that's too big of a number to not have developed some sort of response to it in a more timely fashion. Again, hindsight's 20/20. I'm sure management of CSN would talk more about that. But we evaluated that and decided to write that as a finding because of the holes in the system that allowed it to occur. Finding number 9 is a qualified opinion, and that's why we wanted to discuss it up here. It's with respect to research and development and subrecipient monitoring. Subrecipient monitoring and what that means is when you receive grant funds and then you pass those grant funds through to another entity. So you receive money and then you give it to a nonprofit or another local government or someone else to carry out or administer part of the award. It's common, but this is a very high risk area in federal grant compliance because you're taking money that you're responsible for and you're giving it to somebody else to then administer that part of the program. And there's an inherent monitoring that's required over that. And then in federal regulation, there's required monitoring over that. So you need to perform risk assessments for noncompliance. You need to ensure your subawards and your agreements have all the required information. You need to actively monitor those other entities to make sure they're doing what they're supposed to be doing. You need to look at their audit results to monitor any corrective action, because if you pass through money to an entity and they have a bunch of findings and they've got a poor internal control environment, you need to be aware of that because you're giving them the federal money that you're responsible for, and you need to monitor that they're spending it appropriately. And when we performed our testing, the details are in the context of the finding, but we found that largely across the institutions that we tested, there were breakdowns in subrecipient monitoring to a high quantity and a high iteration rate. And because of that iteration rate and the number of breakdowns in internal controls or procedures that we saw, it necessitated a qualified opinion. It just wasn't compliant with federal regulations. And so, you know, our recommendation there is really to establish subrecipient monitoring procedures, establish a process, and then really follow up on that process and follow through with that to ensure the system's compliant with subrecipient monitoring. Finding number 12 was the other qualified opinion that we noted, and this is over student financial assistance and particularly enrollment reporting. And what happened here is under student financial aid, when students change status, meaning they go from full-time to part-time or half-time, or they withdraw, some sort of status change in their enrollment, that's required to be reported to a national student clearinghouse. And when we performed our testing with respect to NSU, we saw that 20 of the 60, again, our sample was only 60, but that's of a large population size, but roughly a third of who we tested were reported late, an average of 31 days late, and then 4 of the 60 that we tested reported inaccurate status changes. And when we evaluated the iteration rate of this, it was just too high of a percentage with respect to our sample. If you project that out over the population, it's a large impact on the population. And so we qualified the opinion basically due to the iteration rate that we saw there. Overall, and I know I only covered three of the findings in detail, but you'll see a number of findings where there's nothing reported of a compliance error, but we didn't see an internal controls. And when we came in as the auditors, we focus heavily on internal controls, and we evaluate the whole control environment. And so tone at the top is important. Your overall risk assessment's important. The overall nature of the organization is important. But one key control that we focus on is segregation of duties. And when we look at segregation of duties, we mean a review process. So if somebody prepares something, does somebody else look at it? And two particular areas for the system that we found had some gaps were in what we call cash management, but those are reimbursement requests to the grantor. So if you spend money, you request money from the grantor to reimburse you for those expenses. And we saw a number of instances where those reimbursement requests were being prepared by one person, submitted by one person, and they didn't have a layer of review in there. The other side that we saw a lot is reporting. A number of the grants require reports to be submitted to the grantor, whether they're financial or programmatic and objective-based. And when we looked at these reports, again, similarly, prepared by one person, submitted to the grantor without a secondary review, and a number of our findings are errors in the reports, errors in the cash draws, or a lack of segregation of duties there. I do want to say that throughout the entire audit, management and staff were very professional, very cooperative. They were a pleasure to work with. None of these items were, you know, hidden from us or not discussed at length. We did discuss them at length. In some cases, management tried, you know, defended their positions, and we discussed it and went through it. But overall, it was a very positive experience interacting with staff and management. Again, I know there's a number of findings, but management was great to work with. Real quick, just to point out, there are new standards coming up. In 2024, GASB 100 was implemented. Next year, just as a highlight, compensated absences will be implemented for the system as a whole. That changes the accounting for sick, vacation, comp time, all those leave balances. So there will be an adoption of a new standard for the system next year. You'll see the impacts of that in next year's audit. But I did just want to point out that there is a new standard implementation. So with that, I know I went relatively quickly, but I would be happy to entertain or answer any questions anybody may have.
Chair Escada, this is Susan Brager.
Regent Brager, please.
Sorry, and I don't know why there's feedback. So I apologize if you're hearing that also, but in regards to this audit, who did the last audit that so many findings came up this time? Is this the first time you've done this audit?
Yeah, Kurt Schlicker, I'd Bailey with the record. This was our first year as the systems auditors. Your previous auditor was Grant Thornton.
Okay, and then a question to the, I guess, how do we get that last audit to compare what happened and if something was not looked at in a manner, in a timely manner to correct? I don't have that. So I guess I would like to know, not from you, but from staff, how we get that to compare what happened last time to this time, because this seems pretty serious to me. So thank you for that.
Regent Brager, this is Chris Vitone, the Chief Financial Officer for the system. I would the current year single audit actually also at the back of the audit report includes an update on those findings that were reported by Grant Thornton under the last audit. So we do have in the audit committee's records from earlier in 2024 when that 2023 audit was finalized, so I could provide that link to you for the full report as it was presented by Grant Thornton at that time, but probably more convenient is just at the back of this year's report that that is reference materials A4B.
No, I did see that. I'm sorry, and I'm interrupting. I did see that part of it, but I just wondered, comparing to that, I didn't do that analysis yet. So I guess that's what I was looking for. I did read the whole report, but it just still seemed like there was a lot more findings this time.
There are definitely more findings in this year's audit report. And again, I think as Mr. Slicker noted, there were more programs reviewed as a result of some of the federal awards related to the ARPA funds and that sort of thing. So there were more programs reviewed, and not uncommonly, I think you one of the advantages of rotating audit firms is having a new set of auditors taking a different perspective and often identifying things that may have not been overlooked but may have been viewed at differently by the prior firm.
Thank you, CFO Baton. Regent Breger, do you have additional questions?
Sorry. No, I appreciate that explanation because we need to make sure that when the public's listening to this, that we're not just remiss, but different things were looked at each time. And so I think that's an important statement, so I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Well stated. Any other questions?
Chair Arascata, this is Regent Del Carlo.
Please, Regent Del Carlo.
Thank you, Chair Arascata. I just had a lot of concerns on the CSN, and I didn't even know about it. I had not read the material prior to my meeting with the acting president. So I was hearing that for the first time, and, you know, certainly nothing against you, Dr. Kibler, but apparently this was found out in January is what I was told of this year. And here it is, December. We got our materials dropped on November 21st. I just think somebody was really remiss in not letting the board know that this was even going on. $7 million in fraud is huge, absolutely huge. And I was really, I have to say, I was appalled not to know about this, that we didn't get a region alert, that we weren't notified, that, I mean, I don't even really know what's really been done to mitigate any future. And if, I mean, I did have a call with our interim chancellor, and I'm assuming the council of presidents are taking this very seriously and all looking at it. I do know in my conversation with Dr. Dinelli at GBC that she had some similar suspicions on some things and was able to speak with CSN through it. But I even called the Association of Community College Trustees because I'm very active in that organization. And in the 8 years I've gone to their leadership congresses, I've never even heard of ghosting. This fraud, and apparently it's pretty rampant out there. And I was directed to Google California, and they have a lot of problems there. But I just want to be assured, as a region and a fiduciary of this system, that every step is being taken to prevent this from ever happening again, and what our best practices are going to be. So if I could hear from our chancellor or someone to just give us some reassurances that, I mean, and we'll have to pay this money back. Is that correct?
Certainly. For the record, Patty Charlton, interim chancellor. And so thank you, Regent Del Carlo. And just for your knowledge, we were made aware at the end of, I would say, May or June by former CSN president. And actually, we were fortunate that Dr. Kibler had been named, and we jumped on it onto a joint phone call before you had even arrived. So they were in a research mode as it pertained to this specific issue to identify the significance or the depth of what the issues were. In conversation, also, they kept our chief internal auditor, Lauren Tripp, aware, as well as Vice Chancellor Vitone, because this was evolving and we were not actually sure what the significance of that was. The benefit that we also have is that we do, in addition to the business officers meeting together, we also have the student affairs folks and the financial aid directors across the system that come together. And so it is unfortunate that this happened at one of our institutions, but the ability to share that knowledge and to identify best practices to mitigate when that happens, if it happens, and CSN did take immediate action from what we have learned through this process. And so it is a serious issue, and yes, the way that financial aid works, and I'm not an expert in this, but the funds are actually, once they're dispersed, it does become a receivable to the institution because the federal government will pull back them. They call it a pullback, and so that award amount is reduced. So that will sit on CSN's books, either through remedying, through collections, if that's appropriate, and or a potential write-off. And so I think President Kibler would be best to answer that. But to your point, yes, we definitely look at this from a system perspective. And I know I've even had a conversation with President Donnelly as we were talking about large enrollment growths, and that was the very first thing that we had asked is, are we sure on this one? And they have some significant processes. And again, that's the benefit of all of the presidents and the student affairs officers, business officers, all working together.
Could I have a follow-up, please? I guess my question was really, why weren't we alerted? Why, if you knew in May and we didn't, was in the briefing paper on November 21st, where what happened there? Because, I mean, that's plenty of time to let the regents know something this serious happened.
Certainly for the record, Patty Charlton, we did make board leadership aware. We did also have conversations with, again, we jumped on phone calls with even Region Arizcata. We provided we received supplemental information. And so I would ask, I think it probably was also remedy of the, or an issue as it pertained to the transition of the president, because it did happen previously. And so we were still trying to research it. So, but I take your point that regardless, somebody will notify the board as these things occur, either through the system, through the audit office, or through the institution.
Thank you. I mean, I don't like surprises, and I don't like reading anything in the newspaper, although this wasn't, but something this serious, we certainly should have had an alert. Thank you.
This is Susan once again, if I may, Chair Arizcata.
Please go ahead, Regent Brager.
And I want to, I don't like to usually echo anything, but I'd like to echo what was just stated. Chair or not chair of something, the full board needs to be recognized to know these issues. And that's why I'm repeating it. It's that important. So I hope this never happens in the future, that we find something out so late. This is something that this or anything else that happens, we need to be notified, even if we're not chair or on the committee. And I'd like that to be noted.
Thank you, Regent Brager. Couple items in regards to what our interim chancellor just stated. I didn't know about this until the day in which we were notified on the 21st, like as in Regent Del Carlo. So I too want to echo Regent Del Carlo's sentiments in regards to the frustration in which we're notified in such a late kind of a lackadaisical motion. We should have been notified quite earlier, and the severity of this is, it's grave. My question, two questions are, the total hit to the system in regards to the finances, and what was paid back was reimbursed, and what is going to be upon the shoulders of CSN?
Bill Kibler with CSN for the record. Our estimated financial liability, when all the dust clears, which we think by the end of this semester it will, but will be between $7 and $7.5 million.
And how are those finances going to be reimbursed?
I may have to defer to our chief financial officer to give you the specifics of where that source of funds will be. Of course, that $7.5 million breaks down into several categories, some of which have been discussed: outstanding tuition and fee receivables, financial aid reversals, a bad debt write-off, mandatory Pell Grant recalculations, return of Title IV, funds, you know, with no GPA posted, those had to be refunded in those different categories that lead to that grand total of between $7 and $7.5 million. Go ahead, Rolando.
For the record, Rolando Mosqueda, Interim Vice President of Finance and Administration, College of Southern Nevada. Regent Atascada, to your question with regards to the ability of CSN to manage the fiscal exposure related to the GHOST students. There's, as Dr. Kibler stated, there are various categories of funding, and I can provide you a detailed report that we have authored and shared. However, much of the funding was released to the GHOST students via financial aid. That money has been returned back to the federal government, and so therefore CSN is liable for that portion. There's also a large balance of about $3.5 million related to outstanding student tuition and fees that CSN would not realize. Much of that has gone to collections, primarily because CSN was not aware how many of the students that had not yet paid their tuition and fee balances were actually GHOST students. There's little hope that we will receive any of those funds through the collections process. So CSN is on the hook for approximately $7 million that we will have to identify institutional resources to address.
Chair Erskine, I have a question.
Regent O'Carla.
Thank you, Chair Erskine. I have a question. I mean, does insurance cover this, any of this?
Rolando Mosqueda, for the record. Thank you, Regent DiCarlo. We have worked with the NSHE risk management team to file an insurance claim. As of last month, that insurance claim was denied for various reasons. It doesn't necessarily fit within a specific category related to the insurance coverages. And I don't want to put our risk management team on the spot if they're here. But we were notified about a month ago that claim has been denied.
Okay. And then you said something had gone to collections, but if these are GHOST students, how can it go to collections? I'm a little confused there. Thank you.
Rolando Mosqueda, for the record, it's a great question. The challenge is that these individuals, in order to perpetuate the fraud, used stolen credentials. So they filled out FAFSAs with real Social Security numbers, names, and addresses, and it was impossible for us to identify real student from fraudulent student as this was progressing. We have a better handle on that now, but in full candor, it's still very difficult for us to identify if an individual is fraudulent or not. So we're sending them to collections as our normal process. But when we can identify a fraudulent student, we are not doing that. But again, in most instances, these students look real.
So what are the controls that are in place with having this have happened? Now what are the controls so this doesn't happen?
So when we're talking about remedial measures, I'm going to also bring in my colleague, Vice President Juan Avalos from Student Affairs, and he has led significant efforts in terms of remedial measures.
For the record, Juan Avalos, VP of Student Affairs at CSN. I'd like to start with a general answer, primarily because I don't want to disclose all of the specifics of what we've done to protect, because we don't want bad actors attacking the protections. One of the things we found was as we adjusted, they adjusted. And so the bulk of the issue for us, sort of in the fall, just give you a general timeline. In the fall, we saw a slight uptick in suspicious activity. 5 students here, 10 students there, 15 students there, all within the space of financial aid. And so as those were identified, queries were run to look for patterns that we were seeing. And with regular protocol, anytime we identified potentially fraudulent activity, we'd report it to the Office of Internal General's Office for follow-up. And that was essentially our experience in the fall. The reason why January is given as a date of when it was discovered is because that coincides with the first day of classes when people, students, actually would show to class, right? Prior to that, there are names in a system, and at that moment, there are actual people. And we began to get reports from faculty that they had full rosters and empty classrooms. Hmm. And at that point, right, when everyone's registered and everyone's already in, like, it's hard to do something about that for spring. So spring was one of those where, like, that was when you recognize the magnitude that we were essentially fighting computers, right? That was the bulk of it. So immediately we went into investigation mode and protection mode, not so much for spring, because a lot of that had already happened, but really looking at spring late start and looking at summer and looking at fall, because those were coming upon us very quickly. So we began to implement, we implemented about 7 layers of filters where a bot couldn't just move through a process and really sort of broke those steps. And wherever we had any kind of suspicion, we placed holds on students' records for registration, placed holds on financial aid, place holds on disbursement, and essentially force people to come in, show ID, government issued ID, in order for them to be able to continue in a process. If they were unable to do that, and they had enrolled in a class that maybe hadn't started, we started disenrolling students. We disenrolled, for example, for fall, we disenrolled thousands of students that didn't comply or didn't meet those requirements. So through additional filters, through requiring IDs, and then ultimately disenrolling, you know, putting holds and disenrolling people, we feel pretty comfortable, confident that as it came to summer and for fall, that our measures were taking effect. And we've looked at some preliminary evidence for fall as we look at historical data, and we see the numbers in last spring sort of pop up, and the numbers are going back to where they should be. So, for example, financial aid applications in November always hovered around 700, 800 applications. Last November, they were about 1,000, 1,200, and they're back down to about that normal range of 700 to 800. So all of the evidentiary points point to we're back to normal, where we were prior to the ghost student. So we feel pretty comfortable that we've mitigated a lot of those issues. We're still looking to reinforce, and part of it is looking at, I know the NCHI was looking at a number of external entities that do this kind of identity verification sort of upfront. I know there were some vendors that were looked at, and we're definitely looking at some of those solutions. Because ultimately, our fix is having computers fight computers, because that's the magnitude of the issue we dealt with. So, I mean, we have some reports that have more details of the actual specifics, and I could also produce a timeline of what did we know when we knew it, kind of since the fall, so you could kind of see it evolving in terms of what we were aware of and how we responded. So we have that available for you if you'd like that as well. I'm not sure if I answered the level of specificity, but I wanted to give you kind of the big nugget components.
I appreciate your response, and I understand you can't get into all the detail, but I just wanted to make sure that this doesn't happen again. I mean, I guess they went after you being the biggest. It's a little bit sometimes when you're small. Dr. Dinelli was able to really notice it right away, I guess, and because I had thought as a regent, oh my gosh, their enrollment's up. I'm so happy because they really took a big hit during COVID. Oh, this is really great. And then to find this out is really, really deflating, I have to say, plus yeah. The cost to the institution. And I would ask too, is this going to help hurt CSN for their accreditation? Will this hurt at all? I mean, I don't know. I'm asking the question.
For the record, Patty Charlton, Interim Chancellor. Regent Del Carlo, that's a good question. No, because I don't believe that that would have an impact on their accreditation status. The institution, as Vice President Avalos mentioned, recognized some trends. They were notified by faculty, which was really important, and they took the steps. And we'd be happy to also coordinate with the institution some confidential briefings so that you can actually get into a little bit more of that, those details. It is difficult, especially with community colleges have such a large population, and they typically are more of a target because of the high level of Pell that occurs. And so I think some of the technology solutions that CSN implemented, as well as some policy changes that they have also implemented, will assist in this. But the institution is always looking to stay ahead of those individuals looking to create bad situations.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Regent Del Carlo. But going back to the original speaker, like Regent Del Carlo and Regent Brager and the rest of the Audit, Compliance, and Title IX Committee, we heard about this on November 21st. You just mentioned some items in which you had reports on, yet we were never notified. And I know Regent Del Carlo mentioned this earlier about a lack of communication and the frustration that we're hearing about it just, well, recently. We should be hearing about this a lot earlier. And I want to echo Regent DeCarlo's sentiments on that. Are there any other questions from the committee in regards to this specific item? Thank you.
Chair Arascada, this is yes. Amy Carvalho. Can I ask a question quickly?
Oh, of course, Madam Chair, please.
Thank you. Well, first, I'd just like to say that I did hear about this probably a bit earlier than others, but I do want to say that it was in the investigation stage, and it was clear to me that there was a lot of work happening at the time, and I didn't think that it was necessary to say anything. But I hear the concerns, and I will be sure that it wasn't anything on my part that was trying to be hidden from anybody. So I want to make that very clear. I wanted to respect the process of the investigation that was happening at the time that I learned about it. Regarding the significant deficiencies, is there a work plan for coming back to the committee to be sure that these deficiencies have been resolved? I know that in the larger report, it does go into explanations from each of the institutions, but I'm just curious if there is a regular follow-through with significant deficiencies, and these specifically that are in this report. Thank you.
Chair Carvalho and Regent Arascada, I think Lauren Shipp would be the best to provide the process in which the board will hear and the committee will hear the follow-ups on these various findings.
Lauren Shipp. Lauren Tripp, Chief Internal Auditor. Yeah, so there's been instances where in the past we've had significant findings that required some additional follow-up, so we could definitely put something on the next agenda to, I don't know, something to show the progress towards where we were and where we are now.
Thank you. I think that would be beneficial for the committee and the board. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Carvalho. One of the items I want to redirect ourselves on is to agenda item number 4B. I realize that was a 268 or 9 pages in which we had to go through. However, a couple of questions for the R1 Institutes. Beginning on page 115 of that 169, for the rest from the reference material, there's a significant amount of collaboration with federal dollars in respect to the schedule of expenditures of federal awards. I fully understand that these are from the two R1 institutes, but beginning on that 115 to 133, I have a question regarding the collaboration between the both med schools and the respective research departments throughout the country and the expenses involved for the collaboration and with the research and expense necessary for the appropriate outcome. And perhaps the representatives from the School of Medicine's, both the University of Nevada, Reno and University of Nevada, Las Vegas, can just speak about the necessity of the expenditures in order to provide the top-notch R1 institutes.
For the record, Mark Kahn, Vice President for Health Affairs and Dean of the Kirk Accordion School of Medicine at UNLV. Mr. Chair, if I understand your question correctly, both institutions, both medical schools, Dean Hauptman and I, there are several large grants that we'd like to work on together and intend to work on together. One of those is called the CTRIN grant, which is a grant that promotes clinical trial design. And those are grants that are multi-institutional. Dean Hauptman and I and our respective research teams are in the process of putting teams together. We actually have teams together, but are in the process of putting together that grant, probably for submission next year. Those are grants that are in the order of magnitude of $10 million plus. But I think I can speak for Dean Hauptman to say whenever there's an opportunity for us to work together, we both recognize that we're stronger together and that the state is better when we work together. Thank you.
Thank you, Dean Kahn. Greatly appreciate it. And staying in that same thick document with what you just said, Dean Kahn, beginning on page 199 of the financial statement findings, there's specific conditions were identified with inadequate internal controls to ensure the components of the net positioning. Thankfully, with the assistance of Ida Bailey, the effect of inadequate internal controls have been identified. I want to commend Ida Bailey to assure the reconciliation. And on that same, with that being said, both Truckee Meadows Community College, University of Las Vegas, and University of Nevada, Reno, and the system administration, but on page 201, there are causes that were identified of inadequate internal controls. I was hoping that can be just touched upon, because each of these findings and remedies to circumvent the issues for repetition, although they are identified on page 239, there's some items that need to be highlighted, and I was hoping that Ida Bailey can just touch upon a few of those.
Thank you, Kurt Schlicker, partner with Ida Bailey for the record. I'm Regent Arascada. When we note inadequate internal controls, what we're noting specifically is usually, almost always, it's an inadequate review process that's taken place. Sometimes it's due to one person performing it. Sometimes it's due to the reviewer not catching something, but either way, that's still kind of an inadequate review process that's in place. So whether it's financial statement findings, whether it's uniform guidance findings, usually when we say there's inadequate internal controls, most of it boils down to there needs to be an enhanced review process put into place. Every once in a while, it's due to a new standard or a new requirement that maybe somebody just doesn't know. So in those cases, it's more of an education requirement, and then once they know, they usually can fix it going together. But for the majority of the findings that you referenced, Regent Arascada, the inadequate internal controls is primarily with respect to the institutions needing to enhance their segregation of duties and enhance their review process over either the financial balances or various grant reporting requirements.
Thank you, Mr. Schlicker. And there'll be follow-up on our future quarterly meetings in regards to some of these items. Oh, Thank you. Let's move on from number four, because this agenda item is for possible action. I was curious if there's a motion on the table.
This is Regent Del Carlo. I'll make a motion to approve.
Thank you, Regent Del Carlo.
Second.
Thank you, Regent Breger. Motion on the table and seconded was the communications to those charged with governance and the uniform guidance audit report and financial statements are being accepted from Ide Bailey. All those in favor, please say indicate by saying aye.
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 All opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Mr. Slicker, for that very descriptive and well-placed presentation. Let's move over to agenda item number five, please. Communication to those charged with governance and financial statements from the University of Nevada Las Vegas School of Medicine. If we could go to another representative of Ide Bailey, I believe it's Ms. Gravelin.
That is correct. For the record, Renee Gravelin, partner with Ide Bailey, and I was the partner in charge of the UNLV Medicine doing business as UNLV Health Audit, so we'll be going through that. I did not get the tutorial on the... Okay, thank you. So we'll be going through the financial statement audit. The single audit was done on a consolidated basis, so any of the grants that were received by UNLV Health were part of the audit that Mr. Schlicker just reviewed. So the financial statement audit, we look at the report on the audit of the financial statements. The financial statements present fairly. That was our conclusion. Management's responsibilities are for the preparation and fair presentation of the financial statements, as well as the design, implementation, and maintenance of internal control. And then that last bullet I do like to point out, because the audit opinion changed a couple of years ago, and it does mention that term going concern. And historically, if that comment was in the financial statements, that was a problem. However, it really comes down to that management has to continually believe and think that it is a going concern. So it doesn't indicate a problem, so I did want to point that out. Then the audited financial statements go through the auditor's responsibilities. This part was expanded quite a bit a couple of years ago. As Kurt mentioned, we look to obtain reasonable assurance, which is a high level of assurance, but it's not absolute assurance. As Mr. Schlicker indicated, we'd have to audit 100% of the transactions, and that is not how an audit works. But we do look at risk areas, et cetera. We exercise professional judgment. We do identify and assess the risk of material misstatements. That's done as part of a brainstorming session after discussions with management to identify those areas where it is more likely an error could occur. We do obtain an understanding of internal control as part of the audit. We don't give an opinion on internal control specifically, and this is all internal control over financial reporting, not the uniform guidance. And then we look at the appropriateness of accounting policies and reasonableness of significant estimates. And the thing with UNLV Health being a healthcare-related facility, the risks are a bit different than what they are with the rest of the NSHE entity. So I have a couple of slides on that. And again, that conclusion on going concern, that resides in both the accounting side and the audit side, so you'll see a mention of that in that audit opinion. There is required supplementary information. UNLV Health does a very detailed management's discussion and analysis, including a lot of graphs, so I'd recommend looking at it, and then the additional reporting required by government auditing standards. So the financial statement audit for UNLV Health, the areas of focus, similar to what we heard previously, the balances that could be material to the user. The accounting and audit guidance has really focused more on the user of the financial statement and what would be considered important to them. The significant risks, whether due to error or fraud, and keeping in mind significant risks is an audit concept. So again, not something that you necessarily have to stay up at night worrying about, but this really is kind of a roadmap of where we likely spent most of our time during the audit. Management override of controls, again, as Mr. Schlicker mentioned, is always an identified significant risk because there's always a potential it could happen. improper revenue recognition, especially in a healthcare world, because of how things are billed and medical records and all the documentation that has to go into that. There's usually a delay, so that does become an even more significant area to make sure that the revenue is being recognized in the proper period. The allowances for contractual adjustments and bad debts, this is very unique to healthcare. So contractual adjustments, as an example, would be with an arrangement with Medicare. Bill is $1,000, Medicare is only going to pay $700, there's $200 that's a contractual adjustment that wouldn't get collected from anybody. And then the $100 might be in terms of co-payments or deductibles, that type of thing. So in the case of UNLV Health, approximately 70% of the total charge ends up being a contractual adjustment, so there's only that net of 30. So that is a very large estimate within the financial statements, and it's very complicated because each payer has different rules or has different arrangements. So again, that's where we did spend the majority of our time. In addition, with UNLV Health, there is a significant amount of related party balances and transactions, and by nature, related parties transactions tend to be more risky. Not saying anything happened at UNLV Health, but if we do look back on many of the accounting frauds and failures that happened that hit the news, i.e. Enron as the big example, much of that fraud was done via related party transactions. So we do spend a lot of time looking at that as well. So just a couple of items within UNLV Health. One of the things we do look at the prior year, even though the audit report is only a single year, we tend to go under the assumption that things are going to be relatively the same as the prior year unless we know of changes. So what you see here is a graph of the operating revenues for the current year. However, if you were to look at the prior year, for example, that net patient service revenue amount is about $58 million this year. Last year, that was about $40 million. So that was a significant increase of about 44%. Contained within that number are three areas. One would be the actual hospitalist-type clinic services that are performed. That increased about $4.7 million from the previous year. But then in the current year, and a little bit in the last prior year, there was a change in a program. The upper payment limit and the Medicaid managed care supplemental payments. And the way this program works is there's money that's provided to the federal government, they match it and redistribute it. Last year you received about $2.3 million of upper payment limit. This year it was about $2.9 million. The program was new last year, and last year you recorded nothing related to the Medicaid managed care. This year it was about $12.4 million. So that really is accounting for most of that increase. There's a slide coming up about those supplemental payments, and I'll go through it just a little bit more then. The net contract revenue and the other revenue stayed very similar to the previous year, but in total the revenue increased about $18 million, of which $15 million related to that upper payment limit, so about 28%. This graph is very important, the net patient service revenue, which is also something we look at. That large blue one, the 50%, that's Medicaid revenue, so most of the revenue within UNLV Health relates to Medicaid. That is why you receive the dollar amounts you receive from that supplemental program is because you take care, or UNLV Health takes care of a significantly higher proportion of Medicaid patients than other organizations. So that is directly correlated to the amount of funds you received under the supplemental payment program. So this UPL, upper payment limit, and MCO supplemental payment program is relatively new. It just started last year. Again, there was only about $2.3 million of upper payment limit amount recorded last year. Management has had to make certain estimates, and so there is a timing difference that occurred this year. There was the MCO supplemental payment last year, however, that wasn't made last year. It wasn't made in fiscal year 23. It was made in fiscal year 24. And the calculations are so complicated, and a lot of the information resides with the state. So management was unable to make that estimation. So there's about $2.8 million that was recorded in fiscal year 24 that related to fiscal year 23. That was just a change in estimate. So the net impact this year is about $10.3 million of additional revenue because of the level of Medicaid patients that UNLV Health cares for. The operating expenses, again, if you do a comparison to the previous year, they increased about 18% in each overall. Some categories more, some categories less. But a lot of that, one, your volumes were up, which is why your patient service revenue was up. Also, the second to the bottom, that academic support, that $5 million that you see, the $5,017,000, again, that's the payment that's made to the federal government to be matched and then redistributed. So that's why the net impact of that program is about $10 million. I'm not going to go through these related party slides very closely, but just to know, again, there's a lot of related party activity. You can see that $5 million is due to KSOM, and then there's other expenses, so there's about a $9.3 million amount. However, UNLV Health is still waiting to receive about $7 million of that upper payment limit, so that's part of the reason that that balance is higher in the previous year. And you can also see the total expenses to KSOM, just under $30 million. There's also a lot of leasing activity with facilities and that type of thing, so about 97% of the lease expenses, the lease balances, the assets, et cetera, are either with KSOM or UNLV. So again, a lot of activity in that area and a lot of audit time spent going through these particular balances. So Kurt went through the three findings because of the material noncompliance. I did not list that one here, the material noncompliance related to the single audit or the uniform guidance. The material weakness and significant deficiency that Kurt went through, it's the same definitions. For UNLV Health, for their internal controls over financial reporting, we did not identify any that would be considered a material weakness. So that was kudos to the group there. They have had some turnover in their staffing and had brought in a contracted person who has now been hired, and that has really helped segregate those duties out so that they do have someone preparing, someone reviewing, et cetera, as well as they have many CPAs working in that group and have been able to work through some of the issues that they'd had historically. As Mr. Schlicker indicated, management and staff at UNLV Health were very professional and cooperative. There were some areas with just trying to get some of the reports out of the electronic health record system that's used, which is called EPIC. It's a very large system, and sometimes trying to get those reports, working very closely to get that information, and they were very attentive to our requests. After we left the field, we had weekly meetings. Everybody was very willing to jump on those calls, and we did challenge a lot of the internal controls, policies, and procedures to get that information, especially as a first-year auditor looking through it differently. Kurt mentioned this already. There will be the compensated absences that would be effective here for fiscal year 25. So we've had some initial discussions with management on that and of UNLV Health to get that adopted. And now I'm willing to entertain any questions.
Are there any questions from the committee or comments?
None from me. A great report. Thank you.
I have no questions. I'm very appreciative of such a clean audit. So kudos to the School of Medicine at UNLV, especially when there's a change of personnel.
Yep. Thank you. I apologize for over speaking. I want to follow in the footsteps of my fellow committee members. The diligence of Ide Bailey with both of these reports is very well respected and greatly appreciated. I also want to commend the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, Kirk Kerkorian School of Medicine, the leadership, i.e. Dean Kahn, and the entire crew down there doing a great job. And it's wonderful to hear that the positivity being provided by the Kirk Kerkorian School of Medicine. So thank you very much. Okay. Any other questions, comments?
Chair Scott, I do have a comment.
Go ahead.
Regent Del Carlo, I just want to say I'm really appreciative of our new auditor. I think it was way past time to change. Nothing against our old auditor. They were 15, 17 years or whatever it was, because I was ready to change the last time we voted, the time before this one, but it didn't go through. But I think it's really healthy, just healthy for an organization to have fresh eyes looking at things. So I appreciate the work you're doing, and we're looking forward to our contract with you.
Thank you.
Well stated. Thank you, Ms. Gravelin. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
As I mentioned, this is for possible action, and I believe we took a vote. Did we take a vote?
We have not yet.
I apologize.
Motion for approval by Susan Brager.
I'll second it, Regent Del Carlo.
Thank you both. Is all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. All opposed? Wonderful. Thank you. We're going to move over to agenda item number 6, which is the overview of Title IX regulatory changes and NSHE policy updates. This is going to be presented by our Senior Associate General Counsel, Linda King. Linda King, please.
Good morning, everybody. Linda King for the record. All right, I'm going to try to do this quickly as we're running a bit late. So I'm here again to talk about the 2024 Title IX regulations. Where have we been and what's new? We started in August at your special meeting where we brought forth policy and code amendments to bring us into compliance with the 2024 Title IX regulations. This committee in September heard from the institution's Title IX coordinators who presented a broad overview of their complaint processes at the institutions. We talked a bit about the injunctions that are in place, which apply to some of the institutions, UNR, UNLV, CSN, and since we last spoke, TMCC has now joined that group. So we have some institutions that are following the 2020 regulations and some that are following the 2024 regulations. The Title IX Coordinators Working Group continues to meet and address many topics, both under the 2020 regs and the 2024 regs. They're refining policy, clarifying definitions and interpretations, issue spotting, working on training, working on resources, collaborating to find ideas to share and reduce costs, and working on consistent reporting mechanisms and processes so we have consistency throughout the system. And they're also arranging for communications with the board's task force on power-based violence. We do anticipate that with the upcoming change in the federal administration, there's going to be impacts to the 2024 rules. How they might change, there's a few ways. Some are more likely than others. When they will change, we don't know, but I would bet 100% that they will change in the spring. So I will probably be back at your March meeting with more information. Ways it could change would be the Department of Education could go through another rulemaking process, either the normal process, which would take longer, or an expedited process. They could form a new rule or make amendments to the rule, or the Department of Education could tackle how the 2024 rule is interpreted and enforced. Or they could wait for the courts to decide the issue with the cases that are pending. So we don't know how it will change, but I would more than bet that it will. So this committee asked for a side-by-side comparison of the 2020 regs to the 2024 regs to look at some of the key changes. So I've got a slide presentation here that I inherited from Eric Gilliland, who is now the former Chief Human Resources Officer for NSHE. These slides are sparse. You will see that. So I'm going to do my best to fill in some information and give you some more detail very quickly, but please interrupt me and stop me if you have questions. In general, could we go to the next slide, please? So we have just some few pointers in your slides about the background. As a reminder, Title IX states, the actual law, not the regulations, no person in the United States shall, on the basis of sex, be excluded from participation in, be denied the benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under any education program or activity receiving federal financial assistance. That's the actual law, federal law, and we deal with the regulations that implement that. And we do, as you know, our policy is in compliance with the most recent regulatory changes. Next slide. The key regulatory changes for the 2024 rule is intended to provide broader protections, introduce flexibility and fairness, enhance the role of Title IX coordinators, and provide a more inclusive framework to address discrimination and ensure equity in educational settings. So the first thing that has changed is the definition of sexual harassment. In 2020, the regulations dealt with sexual harassment. It was very narrowly defined, and it was defined as severe, pervasive, and objectively offensive conduct. So in the theme of broadening protections, the 2024 regulations have broadened the definition, which is now referred to not as sexual harassment, but sex-based harassment. And this includes discrimination on the basis of sex stereotypes, sex characteristics, pregnancy and other related conditions, sexual orientation, and gender identity. And you'll notice that the standard has been changing the and to an or. The impact that this has is that there will be more a wider range of behaviors that may be considered sex-based harassment, which could increase the caseloads at our institutions and therefore increase the amount of resources that the institutions need to address the caseload. Next slide. A second key change is the jurisdiction and scope of Title IX. In the 2020 regulations, it was all about geography. Where did the conduct occur? And it was limited to an institution's United States programs and activity. In contrast, the 2024 regulations focus on the impact to the education program or activity. So it's expanded potentially to include off-campus locations. It definitely includes study abroad programs. But with our off-campus locations, you would then look at the conduct that occurred and whether or not it significantly impacted the complainant's education access to or benefits from an education program or activity. So again, this can expand the cases that might come into your respective Title IX offices at your institutions and increase the workload. Next slide. Supportive measures. Supportive measures have always been a part of Title IX. Supportive measures are things that the institution can do to assist complainants and respondents when they're going through, they've made a Title IX complaint and they're going through the process and the complaint procedures. So the 2020 regulations required supportive measures for both parties. So that's your complainant and your respondent. Prior to the 2020 regulations, supportive measures were really only focused on complainants. So in 2020, we did see the equity where we would be providing supportive measures for both parties to the case. In 2024, we maintain that equity, but we've provided the regulations have provided a new right, and that is the ability to challenge. It's referred to in the slide as an appeal, but it's really a challenge to a supportive measure, whether that supportive measure has been denied, perhaps not granted, or granted in part, or modified in some way, the complainant or respondent can challenge that decision of the institution. This requires an independent decision maker to then look at that challenge, which requires more resources because it requires a new individual in the process. Next slide. Grievance procedures. The regulations refer to the complaint as a grievance. The board's policy refers to it as a complaint, so I'm going to be referring it as complaint procedures. In the 2020 regulations, there were very formal procedures for handling grievances, and it required a written complaint. And in 2020, it also required the institution to have actual knowledge. So there couldn't just be the institution maybe should have known. The institution had to have actual knowledge, which again focuses on that very narrow scope. And in the 2024 regulations, it's much broader. You don't have to have a written complaint. It could be an oral complaint. It could be information that the institution receives that's not even from the party who is alleging that the act occurred. So if the institution has knowledge in general, knew or should have known of this conduct, then Title IX applies. So some additional changes in the grievance or in the complaint procedures are from 2020 is the formality of the process. The 2020 regulations almost brought the process to more of a quasi-judicial or judicial-like setting by requiring formal live hearings that had to occur in person and with cross-examination by the party's advisors. And in contrast, the 2024 regulations permit live hearings, but they don't require it. And they allow other methods of collecting the evidence and questioning the parties. And the parties can be questioned by an investigator or a decision maker. They don't have to be questioned by separate advisors. And while advisors are allowed, the advisors are not tasked with the questioning. Another difference in the complaint procedures is that in 2020, the regulations called for mandatory dismissals. So if a matter didn't meet certain criteria, it had to be dismissed. In contrast, in 2024, it's a permissive dismissal. So the institution isn't bound, if certain criteria exist, to dismiss a complaint. It could still move forward. Next slide. The standard of evidence for our policy purposes hasn't changed. It's a preponderance of the evidence. But the 2020 regulations left an opportunity to choose between preponderance and clear and convincing standard, and the 2024 regulations mandate the use of preponderance of evidence unless the institution's using clear and convincing for other types of complaint processes. It just must be a consistent across your processes at the institution. Again, this doesn't really impact our institutions. Everyone is using preponderance of the evidence. We don't have any other standards. Next slide. Informal resolution. So these are options to resolve. It's an alternative dispute resolution, other options to resolve a complaint besides going through an investigation and decision-making process. In 2020, informal resolution was allowed only if both parties consented to it at the beginning of the process. In contrast, the 2024 regulations have expanded this flexibility and are allowing institutions to choose informal resolution options at any point during the process. This is an opportunity for the institutions to alleviate their caseload, prevent complainants who are victims who may not wish to go through with the complaint process. They don't want to be re-victimized. They don't want to relive their trauma, but they're seeking a result outside of the process. So this is a very good point that allows our institution's flexibility and provides more options to the parties. Next slide. All right, the retaliation prohibitions have always existed. They were just less notable in the 2020 regulations, and in the 2024 regulations, the Department of Education has strengthened protections, and they've included expressly prohibiting retaliation against not just the parties who are involved in the complaint process, but also the witnesses, and it includes peer-to-peer retaliation. This is a change in the law, but this has always been recognized in policy, so again, the impact is not significant for NG. Next slide, please. Mandatory reporting has changed. In the 2020 regulations, only certain employees were required to report harassment that they learned of. And it was a very small percent of employees, a small group of employees that were required to report harassment. And this has been expanded significantly in the 2024 regulations, where unless an employee is designated as a confidential reporter. Well, they're not a confidential employee, excuse me, which means they do not report. Everyone else is a non-confidential reporter and has an obligation. That obligation may not be to report the incident. In some cases, it is. But in all cases, an individual who learns of conduct that may constitute sex-based discrimination under Title IX has an obligation to tell the person who's reporting that incident how to contact the Title IX office, what the contact information is, and to let them know that the Title IX office can assist them in obtaining supportive measures and or filing a formal complaint. Next slide. Pregnant and parenting students and employees. So the 2020 regulations did focus on pregnancy, but the focus was really on employees. There wasn't much mention of students. We did address this in our prior policy, but there were no reporting requirements. The definition of sex discrimination in the 2024 regulations specifically includes pregnancy or other related medical conditions. So it expands the protections, and it provides for reasonable modification. Your slide says accommodations, which we think of more in the ADA context. The Title IX context is a reasonable modification. But it's very similar, and it can be comparable to other medical conditions. What's really significant and what's really focused on students in the 2024 regulations is that if a student notifies an employee of a pregnancy or a related condition, then the employee must provide, again, the Title IX coordinator's contact information, letting that student know that there are resources available that would ensure equity in the educational program. So that is a new requirement. And that is the end of the presentation. It was very quick, I realize, but do you have any questions?
Questions, comments?
Everyone's had enough of Title IX? All right.
Yeah, thank you so much. This is Susan Brager. I appreciate the very thorough report. And that's it from me.
Great, thanks.
Never enough of Title IX. Thank you very much. Because this was an information only item, I'd like to express our appreciation to our Senior Associate General Counsel, Linda Keene, for that very thorough presentation and the side-by-side comparison. Extremely well done. Thank you. We're going to move on to agenda item number 7, which is an information-only item regarding the internal audit compliance and Title IX updates provided by our Chief Internal Auditor, Lauren Tripp.
Thank you, Chair Erskata. Lauren Tripp, Chief Internal Auditor. So this has been a standing item where we can provide some departmental updates and, more importantly, have a placeholder to discuss anything risk-related. It's been used to discuss in the past financial aid-related findings, the risk assessment methodologies, and discuss work the department is completing towards other board initiatives. As you may have noticed, there weren't any audit reports for us to go through on this agenda for approval other than the follow-up audits the committee approved of earlier. But no worries, this can sometimes happen, and it's based on timing. We have about 6 audits open right now, with ones that are really close to the finish line. So I'm expecting quite a few reports to be presented at the next meeting. So big thanks to the team and all their hard work that's going on in the background. The first item I'd like to provide an update on is the incident management system, and then a quick department update at the end. I'm going to use the term hotline interchangeably just because it's a little bit easier for me than saying incident management system over and over again. Before I jump into the attachment and the data there, I thought it might be helpful to provide some background on how the hotline came to be. So why does it exist? The submissions flow, try to clear up some areas that have caused a bit of confusion, and go over some highlights of the briefing memo. So to start off, I'll be providing some background on how the incident management system came to be. So back at the November 16, 2018 special board meeting, Chief General Counsel and the Chief Internal Auditor at the time presented an overview and discussion related to there are two options of either creating an Inspector General position or revising the current structure to provide for a new complaint resolution, public intake, internal review, and follow-up procedures. The Chancellor's Office had requested direction and action from the Board to either create a new position, which was the Inspector General I just mentioned, or modify the existing structure, which would be adjusting the Chief Internal Auditor's responsibilities. During this meeting, there was a robust discussion on what the differences would be between the duties of the new position versus adjusting the roles of the chief internal auditor. This discussion came about because there wasn't a formalized process in place, which appeared to be generating some issues. There was a concern that many regents and others felt that issues weren't equally being addressed. This meeting helped guide whether to have a new position or formalize it. Although individuals should go to the institutions first, this would be a mechanism that people could go to if they felt they weren't being heard. It was mentioned by the board chair at the time that sometimes regents would receive complaints, they would send it to the institution, and the institution would send a response back that everything was fine and they just wanted a little bit more. This would help with additional oversight of those complaints. The meeting ended with general counsel was to come back with details of the plan where the chief internal auditor reported to the board for all clearinghouse matters. At the December 19, 2018 Audit and Compliance Committee, Chief General Counsel and the Chief Internal Auditor presented for approval policy revisions to the Internal Audit Department Charter to incorporate direction and action from the Board during the November 16, 2018 special meeting. Wording adjustments were discussed, ending with a motion to approve. At the June 2019 Board meeting, the former Chief Internal Auditor provided a brief update that an incident management system had been established in the second quarter of 2019. In the time since the December 2018 meeting, the intake process had gone from an ad hoc process to a formalized intake process to triage items and direct them to proper subject matter experts or to add to the internal audit work plan. He mentioned the internal audit charter amendments to include his role as a clearinghouse for matters requiring investigatory activity and establishing a mechanism for incident management. The chief internal auditor also described the new system is meant to complement the avenues the institutions have already in place. So that's just a bit of the history how this the incident management system came to be. I won't read the briefing memo word for word, but since the last report presented, we now have a different hotline vendor. We transitioned from Navix Global to Clearview Connects and have had Clearview Connects. Oh, now that one's going to tie me up. Clearview Connects up and running since July 2024. Before jumping into the details, I think it might be helpful to remind the committee on how submissions flow through to accumulate and present the data you see in that attachment. What will happen is the party submitting the confidential report has the option to call or submit something through the online portal. And I know there's the email address that I have on the briefing memo is pretty long, but that's just copied out directly from our website, so that's a direct link. But you are able to just go to Clearview Connects. I think it's Clearview. You'd be able to type in like clearviewconnects.com and then it'll come up with a box and you can type in either Nevada system and it'll populate and then it'll take you there or NSHE and it'll take you there. So if you can't remember all of that extra stuff on there, that's fine. So what happens is we will receive notification that there's a new case, which by that I mean the party's concern. We have a large variety of concerns that come through us. I'll discuss that a little bit later. Internal audit assists by helping triage these submissions. When a new submission comes in, we need to determine who can best assist in helping us to follow up with that concern. And typically, that's a subject matter expert. We maintain a log on our end, notating things such as who we sent the information to, when, if it's still open, when we close it, the category, financial, HR, safety, etc. We use the spreadsheet to track the cases and trends to help create the charts you see today. Unfortunately, there seems to still be a little bit of confusion over the last few years on what should be submitted here. So I'm going to go over that a little bit, and hopefully this will be helpful to the committee and others to understand the hotline a little better and what our role is and help clarify if this is the right place for your concern. I'll also add, this is in no way to discourage a party from reporting things to the hotline. Like, I just want to mention some things that I've been seeing lately trend-wise, and there might be a better resource out there. As I mentioned briefly earlier, since its inception, we have always encouraged a potential reporting party that if there are resources on campus or in-house, it's best to try and start with those resources. As much as I'd love to say that we are an expert in all areas, we are not. Now, perhaps you don't feel comfortable. There are too many close ties with individuals on campus. This is where we come in as that additional outlet. We are meant to be an additional resource, not an all-inclusive hotline. And by all-inclusive, I mean there's lots of cases that are going out on at the institutions that they're all working through. And so this data in this report does not include that. That's separate from us. We are the additional complement to the resources on campuses. Something that I realize can be frustrating to some is that not all cases are going to result in us as NC Internal Audit performing our own audit or investigation. So as noted in the chart on page 3 of the attachment, you can see that the HR-related cases are a majority of our cases still. Lots of times these are personnel-related concerns, which honestly is not our lane. This is where we must rely on subject matter experts, and we have built relationships on campuses with groups such as Title IX, Legal, HR, other individuals to help review and resolve these issues. Sometimes this will result in outside investigations, but not for 100% of the cases. Another item to clarify and reiterate is we aren't designed to override decisions made by a campus. So think like appeals, changing somebody's grade or grade on an assignment. So far that was discussing the intake to our Excel sheet process and tracking, and then some items that I've seen that have been creating some confusion. So now jumping more into the attached document and some statistics. So typically we do this update earlier in the year after the benchmark report comes out, which is around June-ish. I do plan to get that back on cycle. This year was a little later due to the transition to the new vendor. You might also be wondering why I'm still using Navex, and that's for the benchmark report, and that's because there isn't one for ClearView that I could find. We were able to include some high-level trends and comparisons in the attached briefing memo that's associated with this update. I'm not going to read the report, but I did want to highlight a couple of benchmarks from the recent report to what we're doing here at NG. So during 2024, volume of reports you'll see is significantly lower, especially at the beginning of the year, and I do believe this is because during that period of time, we had an email instead of a third-party incident management system up and running. So since ClearView Connects has been live, individuals are more comfortable submitting through that platform, it appears. So to give an example, quarter three 2024 case numbers were 22, and then that's consistent with quarter three 2023 case numbers, the same quarter previous year, it's added about 20. So another trend I wanted to point out in the benchmark report is anonymous reporting. So for 2023, anonymous cases was, this was below the median anonymous reporting rate of 56% from the benchmarking report data. For 2023, 45% of the reports filed were anonymous. Overall, since inception, 52% of reports filed have been anonymous. So it's important that this option exists because sometimes people, it encourages people who might not want their name out there to come forward to file a complaint. I did want to spend, lastly, some time discussing a trend that is a bit concerning, and that is the substantiation rate. So by substantiation, this means reports that when investigated proved to be correct or partially correct as reported, whereas unsubstantiated are reports that when investigated proved to be inaccurate or we can't prove it's true, there's not enough data. A high substantiation rate reflects a well-informed employee base making high-quality reports coupled with effective investigation processes. So as you can see on that chart on page 3, the benchmark report overall substantiation rate ran pretty stable year over year between about 40 to 44%. And this has not been the case with us. We used to be pretty close, and then you'll see that the substantiation rate for this year is at 6%, whereas the benchmark is in the 40s. So having that bigger gap, one of the main reasons for this trend, I'm going to try to keep this very high level because of confidentiality related to these cases, is approximately 30% of the submissions are from certain individuals who are using this as a resource to go to that it's not designed for. And by that I mean submitting multiple times it, and this is super high level and like the vending machine ate my dollar. Like that's not something I can help with or grades or assignments being submitted to me because I should have gotten A and I got a B. So those things are things that should not be coming to me, and we do, you know, I have to send them back out. So this is also greatly attributing to throwing the reporting percentage by category numbers under environment, health and safety, and other being higher than the benchmarks that have been previously reported. So I kind of broke down for this year, of the 45 cases submitted at the point I did this report, I just categorized them into four general categories, 10 safety, 15 HR, 18 student, 2 fraud. So fraud, these ones were concerns with misuse of assets. With safety, these were ones such as individuals are being too noisy on campus. HR could range from anything from wrongful termination to I'm not getting along with my coworkers, and the student ones could range from unhappiness with an instructor or the classroom setup, they don't like it, to, like I just mentioned, kind of the grades. So those are, that's kind of been the trend for this year, unfortunately. Anyone that knows me knows I am not the best at my poker face, so apologies. And after being involved in this process for over a year, I feel like we're getting to a point where if the trend continues, where the hotline is being used in a manner that it was not designed for, we need that substantiation rate up to make it be used for its intended purpose. So it's just something to think about. And with that, I'll pause before I have, like, I know I'm over and I'm sorry. Just some quick department updates after that. So,
Chair Scott, this is Susan. May I ask a question?
Please.
In regards to the hotline being used for not the right questions to you, could the colleges, the whole system, send a message like they do to their students anyway to let them know the appropriate things that your department can actually do? I know it's a question for Chancellor Carlton.
So good morning. For the record, Patty Charlton, Interim Chancellor. Thank you, Regent Brigger, for that recommendation. I think that another level of shoring up about the intention of the hotline would be helpful as well, because we also recognize, as Chief Internal Auditor Tripp mentioned, is that in some cases people get frustrated because they think that that the Internal Audit Office is going to either change a grade or help with that dollar that got taken by a vending machine, but not to make light of those situations, but to ensure that people know what the hotline is, what the hotline is not, and where they could also redirect concerns that they have that are better appropriately placed with the institutions. So thank you. That's a great recommendation.
Thank you. I appreciate that. It's just that when they have to go through all those, it takes them off task as to the other items that are equally as important to individuals.
Thank you, Regent Brager.
Thank you.
Regent Tocarlo, any questions?
Thank you, Chair Scott. Just one. So you, as the Chief Internal Auditor, you're the screen for the calls, not the company, right? The companies that are providing the service. You're the screen.
Yeah, so Chief Internal Auditor Lauren Tripp. So basically they'll go to the website, they'll submit their claim, it'll kick an email to me to review. So, and when we respond, like say they want to be anonymous, we can still respond to them via the system. The system, that's why the system's there, is basically to still have contact with that person on their case.
Okay, and so if we don't get our substantiation rate up better, are you looking at maybe just doing away with this whole thing? I mean, what if this has been since 2018, do you see value in it? Because I know you've been in the department since then, although that wasn't part of your function.
My poker face is bad right now, huh? No. well, I feel like it is a useful resource if it's used correctly,
okay.
Right? And there are other options because we are paying money for this service, right? So we're paying $6,000 a year. With the old company, it was more. And if you just didn't say like, hey, you know, this trend continues, we're in the 6% or whatever, maybe an email is a better option, but then it does take away the option to be anonymous, unless you just create, I guess, a bogus email maybe. But so I would like to see how this continues to trend, and that would be basically a board decision on how they would want, if they wanted to keep it, change it, you know.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Regent Tocarlo. No questions from me. As this was an information item only, I would like to thank our Chief Internal Auditor, Lauren Tripp, for that information. That was well done.
Oh, Chair Scott, can I say one more thing real fast?
Yes, please.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted to, I didn't know if, first, just two real quick things. One, we had an internal audit manager who started in Reno, who's been there for the past month, and she's terrific, and I'm so glad that she's part of our team. We're really lucky. And then the second being that I think all of you realize I was embedded with the Ide Bailey team this year, And as part of that experience, we get to learn from them. We get a discount off our bill. And this year, I performed the R2T4 section with them, which usually you don't get assigned that as a first-time auditor with a group. So I joked with them that I don't know if I should be offended or flattered that you gave me this section. But either way, I just wanted to thank Ide Bailey for being so welcoming to me, welcoming me to their part of their team, the financial aid directors, as always, for fielding all of my questions over all of these years. I just am really grateful and thankful for those groups. So thank you.
Chair Arascata, Susan Breger, just one more follow-up, if you don't mind.
Please, go right ahead.
Okay. In regards to the question that I asked, could we please get a follow-up as to what the system, whether it's a chancellor or the colleges across the state, are sending out to make sure that this is not overburdening our audit system in regards to questions that are inappropriate for that portion. We want to hear from people, but they need to know the appropriate manner. So I'd like to make sure that we are given a report onto what is happening and what documentation is going out to help with this. Thank you.
Perfect. Regent Breger, you have a perfect segue into our agenda item number 8, which is our new business item. So really quick, okay. Thing, I want to go back to reflect on agenda item number 7. Once again, Chief Internal Auditor Lauren Tripp, well done. Thank you so much. Agenda item number 8. Regent Breger, I'm going to have to ask you to repeat what you just stated.
Okay, I'm sorry. I will ask that as a, my concern is none of my agenda items in 2 years have been an item that I could work on. So I would really like to make sure if I need to get 3 people, I will do it, or if this committee can ask for that. I think this is very important for the system, and I would like that agenda item to be and be fulfilled, that we task the chancellor to have the colleges send out something to their students to make sure they know the appropriate manner of what system they can use to get the proper questions answered and what does go to the auditor and what does not. Thank you very much. And I'm going to be frank and bold here. If I don't see that in the next 2 meetings, and I will get 3 people, and I don't like doing it that way, but I think this is important for the system. Thank you.
I like the strong arm. Not a problem, Regent Breger. That will be on our next agenda item. Are there any other questions, or excuse me, any other items of new business that would like to be identified? None heard. We're going to go to agenda item number 9, public comment. So I will ask for the public comment from the meeting sites first. Is there any public comment from GBC?
There is none at this time.
Is there any public comment from the regional office here in Reno? None. Is there any public comment from the systems office in Las Vegas?
There is none.
Yep. SDS, is there any public comment from the phone?
I do have one caller online. Caller with the number ending in 4648. Please press *6 to unmute. State and spell your name for the record, and you have 3 minutes to address the committee. They're not unmuting, Mr. Chair. That's all we have for public comment.
Thank you much. And with that stated, this meeting is adjourned.
Thank you, Chair Arascata.